Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2760. That's 2760. Tonight we're going to have a wonderful show, and our guest is here, and she has also with her the assistant director. Her name is Marilla Diaz, and the executive director, okay, is Maria Vinci Savatieri and Esquire. I know these people. I'm so proud of them. I had them on, I think it was, oh my God, Maria's busy right this second. Her dog had to go in for emergency surgery. But I had them on about 5 years ago. It was awful, you know, that her dog is in there. What a time to happen. But anyway, she's here. So I'm going to start the show, and I'm going to bring on, first of all, here, Marilla. Let me get her on. Let me open up her mic and say hello to her. She's the assistant director. And we have Bill right here. Hello, Marilla. How are you?
Good. How is everybody doing?
Oh, we're doing fine. We're doing well. Thank you. I'm so sorry that Maria's dog had that, oh, my goodness, emergency surgery. You know, that must be rough.
I know. It has to be. We're very big dog lovers over here.
Right. I'm here, though. My husband just ran in with her, so.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I love all animals, so it hurts my heart when someone's having surgery. See, I said someone like they're a person. Hey, sometimes animals are better than people, all right? But anyway, all right, before we get started here, I do want to read the mission statement. And we have a nice panel that's building here. The number here, by the way, is 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. Okay. The mission statement is as such. We have a singleness of purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so two different ways. Number one is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over that taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse. Presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone, not just in the United States, it's all over the world. It started since the beginning of time. And number two, offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Now, that's just a little bit of what we do here, okay? We do have a wonderful website. That's www.nasca.org. That's nasca.org, okay? And we hope that people will, you know, look at that website because it offers a lot of information. And I see that the CEO, our boss here, he's here also, Bill from California. I'm the vice president, and he's the president. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4. We could use a couple more people. I'll give out the number again, 646-595-2118. Okay? NASCA people out there, we've got a heavy show tonight. And a lot of those questions you ask at times can be answered tonight because we have the people here to do it. Now, I don't want to read the whole bio that Maria has here, but it's really outstanding. And she is the executive director of Deidre's House since 2003. Deidre's House is a nationally accredited child advocacy center and is the only site in Morris County, New Jersey, where child victims of abuse and or neglect can be forensically interviewed and prepared for trial by law enforcement, medically examined, and treated by a pediatric abuse specialist and a clinically counseled in English or Spanish. Okay. And that's all under one roof. And, boy, that means a lot to me because I was
going to Wow, that means a lot to me.
Yes, it's, I know all about that. Being pulled out of school and taken downtown. I know all about that in Staten Island. All right, so this is why you're so near and dear to my heart. That's one of the reasons. And I just want to get in here also, too, and then I'm not going to read any more of the bio. But it says here that they have provided services in over 40,000 child visits. 40,000 child visits.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
That is incredible, and that is beautiful.
It's wonderful is what it is. I think every county, you know, they should have that. You know, it's just amazing. Maria, if you can, I know you're busy, but can you tell us how this came to be, Deidre's House? How did this start?
Sure. Well, back in 1994, the then prosecutor approached our Morris County Board of what they call freeholders, which is basically the government of our county, and said that they had heard of a new model called a child advocacy center, which basically provided one-stop shopping for child victims of abuse and allowed them to be forensically interviewed, medically examined and treated, and clinically counseled, and then prepared for trial all in one place. And it would be a very child-friendly place. It would be a place that would be child-centered and would not further traumatize an already very badly traumatized child. Before child advocacy centers existed, as you know, a child would be brought to a police station, then to a hospital to be medically examined and treated, and then to yet another place to be clinically counseled. With child advocacy centers, the model is that all that occurs in one child-friendly place. So the child feels very comfortable in order to tell their story about what happened to them in a very non-threatening atmosphere. A lot of what a child is revealing is very embarrassing to them and personal, and it can be a little scary. So the whole idea behind a child advocacy center is to give them the opportunity to tell their story in a place that they're going to feel comfortable. And they tell that story in their own words. And then in that same place that now they have been accustomed to and they've been brought to speak to law enforcement, they can come back and be medically examined and treated by a pediatric abuse specialist who's a doctor who's been through a fellowship. She's a pediatrician who's gone through a fellowship in child abuse diagnosis and treatment, and then they come back to be clinically counseled for as long as they need it. And this model is designed so that a child gets hope, healing, and justice in a way that doesn't further traumatize them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. When children have been sexually abused and they go through all that, a lot of times it's horrific abuse where, you know, they're beaten also. And so forth, they certainly don't need to be taken, or you have to go to the hospital. Well, maybe they have to go to the hospital at first. I can see that if they're beaten up badly. But, you know, go to the hospital, get that examination, which is, of course, would be horrifying. It's horrifying to anyone, I'm sure, you know. And then go to the police department, speak to the police officers, maybe sit down at another time, which is what happened to me, and look at mugshots taken out from school in front of my peers who were all snickering. And Maria, I have to tell you something, kids back then, they were kind of snooty back then too. You know, they'd
look
at each
other. I'm so glad you're saying this, girl. I'm very proud of you right
now. Yeah, and point and all this other stuff. And that just adds to it, you know, adds to the horror that you've already been through, is to have your classmates, you know, making fun of you and all this stuff. And then you go down and you look at mugshot after mugshot after mugshot, and day after day after day it happened. It was awful. So finally, I asked my mother to please have them come to the house, okay, and not take me out in front of my peers, because it was just too humiliating. And like you said, you know, a lot of times we're embarrassed, we feel humiliated, we're certainly violated, to say the least, and we need counseling, we need all kinds of things. And way back when, my age group, we didn't get the counseling, all this other stuff. So what you offer at your organization at Deidre's House is so, so, so important. And I want to thank you for that, too.
Thank you. What we try to stress to people is that there are oftentimes we can't prevent the incident that happened to the child. We can't prevent that trauma. But how the adults in their lives react to that trauma makes all the difference in whether a child can recover from that, whether a child's life is going to be defined by that trauma, whether they're going to be able to get past it and heal and lead happy, healthy lives. So it's very important how we respond to child abuse. And because if we give the opportunity of the child to heal, children are resilient. They can heal. But the adults in their lives have to respond appropriately, and they have to respond immediately.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, Morella, one of the reasons I wanted her in the call is Morella is not only our assistant director, and she's also the coordinator of our multidisciplinary team, but she's our clinical, she's a licensed clinician. So she does a lot of the clinical counseling. So she has, she started with us as an intern, became one of our bilingual child advocates, went on to get her master's in social work, and now she clinically counsels the children that we see. So she has a lot of experience about having kids process this trauma in a healthy way and bringing them to a place that they can lead very healthy lives and be successful. So I think Morella can really talk to the fact of why it's really necessary to get kids clinically counseled immediately.
Carol, I thank you for sharing your story, because we often hear from survivors before a child, like when they find out a child advocacy center existed, the first thing we hear is, wow, this is amazing. I would have loved to have this opportunity when I was going through this. And so often what we find, like Maria was pointing out, is that these child victims who have been gone through the most horrific thing in their lives or their family members, we want to provide that hope and healing for them, because it's so critical when this happens to get the treatment that you need. You know, Maria and I talk very often about how if you break a bone, we take you to the doctor, right? It's no question about it. We take those kids to the doctor. They get their cast, and then it heals. But we don't often do that with mental health. We don't often do that when there's trauma, and we just say, oh, you can get over it. Or, you know, sometimes people and families don't disclose because what happens in the family stays in the family. And we want to let them know and let the public know that when these cases happen, when there's trauma, when there's abuse within a family, we need to provide the mental health treatment to these families in order to heal. It's a necessity. It's not a luxury. So we want to make
Absolutely.
Sure
Thank you.
That yeah, we want to make sure that these kids get the treatment. And what's great about Deirdre's House is that our counseling program is both in English and in Spanish. All of our services are free. We could have a victim who comes to us at the age of 5 years old, and at that time, sometimes kids deal with their trauma and what's happened to them in different ways. They might not recognize the severity of what's happened, especially if they're younger. And then we can provide counseling services to their non-offending caregivers, which we often do, and we help them through this process. But our door remains open throughout this process. So if we have a five-year-old, when they become 10 years old, when they become 15 years old, if they get into adulthood and are now in relationships and have difficulty now understand what happened to them when they were younger or in a relationship or these trauma events or memories come up, we can provide them with that counseling service free of charge throughout this process. So not many counseling programs can do that. That's one of the beautiful things about Deirdre's House, is that we have the luxury, because of we're a child advocacy center, because of our gracious donors, that we can provide that service free of charge throughout this process and this healing journey.
And that is so important, because so often, you know, when people, I don't have to tell you, I used to work at Greystone Psychiatric, and if you didn't have good insurance, you know, I'm not going to say you didn't have good therapists or you didn't have good psychiatrists, but, you know, you were treated differently. I saw the patients being treated differently. I was a technician there.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm saying here is by having this door open, available, you know, to the people, even 10 years later, so that they can come in for, you know, counseling. Because let's face it, you know, when we are sexually abused, and with me it was time after time after time, I'm not going to tell you how many times because you would throw up. Okay. So the point is this. When you're sexually abused and you go through all that horrific horror, you're going to have PTSD, chances are, and maybe even complex PTSD. So as you grow and you turn into, say, you say it happened when you were 7 years old or whatever, and then all of a sudden you're 14 years old and you realize that, you know, you're not feeling right and you're not doing well in school, you're not doing well with your peers, you have all kinds of problems with your social skills and all the things, and you should be a happy-go-lucky child at the age of 14, but you're not, because you still have the ghosts from the past. And then maybe by the time you're 18, you still might have ghosts from the past. So by having someone, a therapist, who understands, I use a therapist all the time in this process because I think that's what's needed, but it can come from other areas as well. But have someone who understands child abuse for what it is. No sugarcoating it, okay, for what it is. Maybe someone who walked in our footsteps, okay, those of us who have been abused, all right. They have such a keen observation, it's a keen idea of what it was because they were there. It's so needed. So for you to have that open door policy, you know, at Deirdre's House, that's different from the last time that I spoke to you. And, you know, it's, I think that's wonderful. I think that's fantastic. Let me ask you something. Yeah, let me just ask this last question. I'm going to open up the panel. Do you ever come across, say, like parents who are bringing in their child who's been abused, male or female, all right, and one's blaming the other one's blaming this one, are they arguing? Well, what's the state of mind? You know, can that happen? Can that happen?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, we have parents that they're dealing with their own issues, particularly guilt surrounding about what happened to their child. There could be contentious divorce. There's different parental issues going on. The home life can be very dysfunctional. So what we also do is we offer counseling and parenting education to the parents, because what we found is we have to get the parents educated and on the same page so that they can bring the child through this experience. Because we really see the child maybe once or twice a week, and the parents are with them 24/7. So the parents have to be educated on how to handle the healing process with their child. So we offer the parents clinical counseling also to deal with their issues and also parenting education so they understand what's going on with their child, the signs of stress in their child that will have to be brought immediately to our attention, and all the other things surrounding abuse that they don't maybe not, will not understand. Because oftentimes, as Morella said, parents will say, you know, something happened to me like this when I was your age, and you know what? I just sucked it up and got on with it. And they didn't realize the long-term damage of doing that. Hi, Deborah. So we make sure that we're educating parents so that they understand that this is, you know, if you brought your child to a specialist, like an orthopedic surgeon, because they had a broken leg, you just don't leave a child to heal on their own when they've gone through this kind of trauma. So
right.
We really have to take a stance and educate parents so they know and understand what their child is going through and what their role is in the healing process.
Right, right. And I'm sure that at times, dealing with all these many, many different types of personalities and people, you do come across that quite a bit, where there's anger, rage, you know, and you know, finger pointing happened in my family, so I know. That's, you know, okay, you did that, or you didn't do that, whatever. It's very hard. Let me bring on Bill. He's our founder, okay? And see if he has some questions, or let him welcome you to the show. Go ahead, Bill.
Hello, ladies, and thank you for being here again. Of course, I've been with you before on the other shows that we've done, but I'm delighted to have you back. In fact, we shouldn't have waited this long. As you know, Carol and I were talking about it. We shouldn't have waited this long. But anyway, I think maybe you'll remember I said this before, but I think that the Child Advocacy Center is the best thing that's ever happened. You know, best thing since sliced bread, so to speak, because you know, of all the things that we're talking about here, it is one-stop shopping. It's a non-invasive one-stop shopping where the children are made to feel comfortable. Their parents are made to feel comfortable. The staff is made to feel comfortable. I mean, it's often true that during interviews, there aren't a lot of uniforms and stuff and badges and stuff being worn. You know, in many cases, it's being recorded on video, so it can be used in various ways later, and that might save the child from having to testify, which is another, you know, traumatic experience for a child going up to court. And so anyway, I'm delighted to have you both. I know you've both been involved with Deirdre's House for a long time, and as they say, ever since we found it, we've been huge fans. I wish there was one at least in every county. You know, there isn't, but I think it would go a long way towards helping, you know, with the community knowing where to go when stuff happened. And if you do it for children, of course, you're skipping the years and years, maybe even decades of trauma that they might experience as if it was allowed to go through their adolescence and 20s and so forth and 30s. And, yeah, that's what we want to skip. Mari and Mirella, I'm very, very happy to have you here. Was that going to be a question there? So someone took their breath.
Well, Bill, you made an important point. One of the things that really occurs at any child advocacy center, which is very important, is a child, when they're forensically interviewed, they're interviewed using a special technique called finding words, which doesn't use leading questions, and that interview is recorded, which is very important, like you said, because it can save a child from testifying in court. But also, what's really important to note is the child only has to tell their story once. And anybody who has to view that interview can view the recording, and they don't have to constantly ask the child to retell the experience, which can often be extremely traumatizing. Every time they have to tell it, they have to live through it. So we know that this is very important for them to be able to only tell their story once.
Hold on, you're probably breaking up. Can you still hear me?
I can still hear him, but I don't know who that is.
I don't know who it is either.
One thing I would like to add to the conversation, I know you had mentioned about having access. You know, one of the great things about child advocacy centers is that it's a nationally accredited, it's a national model. So if our client is with Deirdre's House and they relocate to Tennessee, we can find a child advocacy center in Tennessee to provide them the same level of care that's trauma-informed, that's safe, that's child-friendly and child-focused, and that's evidence-based. So that's one of the great things. But the New Jersey Children's Alliance, which is the state chapter of child advocacy, actually had an initiative by 2021. They wanted 21 counties to have 21 CACs, and we actually met that goal. So now in the state of New Jersey, all counties have a child advocacy center. Whether they're accredited or an affiliated member, there is a child advocacy center. You know, our CAC, at Deirdre's house. We are a nonprofit standalone building, which is a beautiful facility. And other CACs are prosecutor-based, so if you, you know, if you're in a different county, you can have a prosecutor's office child advocacy center that's also child-friendly. So I just wanted to clarify that we do have, every county has a child advocacy center, so child victims in New Jersey can get that same level of care.
That is wonderful. I'm so happy to hear that, because think of all the kids, you know, that you know, who are sexually abused or physically, mentally, emotionally abused, neglected, all the abuses. Think about it. They have, you know, the parents don't want them to go into the courtroom. Of course, I mean, who wants to go into the courtroom? I had to go in the courtroom with 13 other girls, and we were so scared. We didn't care. We wanted the man to go to jail, of course, but we didn't want to see him again, okay? And I remember so many of them were so frightened, you know, to even look at this monster, because that's what they looked at him as being a monster. And so you see, that can be in itself, that can re-traumatize and leave a lasting impression. I certainly remember it so well. If I remembered it so well, they all remembered it so well. It's something you don't forget going into that courtroom. So, you know, they don't feel like, excuse me, oh, my. Frog in my throat or something. They don't feel like people are friendly. Yeah, I need something. But anyway, the point is, you know, when you're in there like that, that's a very frightening situation for a child. It just simply is. So I'm glad it's all over the place now.
Yes, and our clinicians and our staff members, one of the things of our Child Advocacy Center at Deirdre's House is we are really grateful that we have the ability to go to court with our clients, to go to court with the child victims and their families when they do have to testify or if they do have a hearing that they have to be at. We help them in the counseling process. We'll help them write an impact statement, a victim impact statement, which is really empowering for the child and their family members. And we also provide support in court. So we'll be there from the beginning of when the family is going through this and it first comes out, and we'll be there at the courtroom to provide that support for the families as well. So it's, and we have some tips and tricks that we use at the courtroom, or we have it at Deirdre's house. We have an animal therapy dog at our center too, which is really great for our clients and their families when, you know, before or after a court hearing. So we do a lot to help provide that support so that it's not a scary process.
But, yeah, and what we also do is we carefully prepare a child for trial if they have to go to trial. We actually have a mock courtroom model that we use with the children so that they know what they're walking into. So they're not going to have the same experience that you had where they're just terrified because they're not knowing what they're walking into. If we can prepare them and they know the environment that they're going to be in and their practice and some of the questions that they're going to be asked, it can bring the stress level down considerably.
Right, right. And that's so, so important. I have Deborah here. Let me see if she'd like to ask a question or make a comment. Deborah from Arizona?
I'm right here. Excuse me. I have to take my tea and my olive oil, too. One of the things I loved what you just said about bringing the child into a mock courtroom, that is so important. For adults, do you talk to adults as well that are going through this process? Because I know I am, and I have this question. Yes, I know who raped me, and I have their address, and I have nobody to talk to. I know I'm not a child. I know I'm 48 years old. But what kind of services would you offer to somebody like me?
Well, we don't normally, we don't offer clinical counseling to adults unless their parents are being, unless their children are being treated at the center. But we do offer resources. So if you were living in New Jersey and you called us and you were asking for assistance, we wouldn't just say to you, oh, We don't do that. We only treat children. We would make sure that you were connected with a service in our county or in close to where you live that would be able to provide the kind of services that you would need. We would also put you in touch with law enforcement. So if you know who your assailant is, you can report that. And one of the things that we have in each county in New Jersey, in each prosecutor's office, is we have something that's called a victim witness advocate. And that's really what we do, but on the scale of adults, where you have a victim witness advocate that can be with you every step of the way and provide you the same kind of support that we give children at the Child Advocacy Center. So if you, in your county, one of the things that you can inquire is, do they have what's called a victim witness unit? And in that unit is a victim witness advocate that can be with you every step of the way from the time, from the first time that they're interviewing you and you're telling your story till when it goes to court. That victim witness will sit in court with you just like we sit in court with our children. So there are services for adults that actually mirror what we do for children, but they are handled at the prosecutor's office level.
And, you know, first and foremost, thank you for being here and listening in. One of the things that you can also access, and this is throughout the country, it's a free confidential hotline number. If you're familiar with the organization RAIN, they have 800-656-HOPE is their hotline number, that if you needed to speak with somebody or you just wanted to vent or ask questions or go into depth about your experience, these individuals specialize. They're the National Sexual Assault Hotline that can provide that support to you at any point.
Thank you very much. That really does help. And, yes, I do know the HOPE hotline. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, there you go.
And I'm just
there
crying just a little bit, so I'm just going to cut my – I'm just crying just a little bit, but thank you.
Okay, honey. All right. Okay, that's good. I'm glad you got that out. It says here, this is so important, too. I know you do speaking engagements. Maria, I know you do, and maybe you do also. I'm not sure, Marilla. But when you go in for speaking engagements, say to a school, now I do it at county colleges, and I do it also at the, I have been, the COVID has messed everything up, as we all well know, but at universities. But do you go into like grade schools? Are you able to get into there?
Yes, we do. And actually, Marilla and I go together. And the reason that we go together is because a lot of the times what happens when we're giving one of these presentations is that a child will inevitably disclose. So Marilla is invaluable because when a child discloses, because she's a trained clinical counselor, she's a trained to deal with childhood trauma, she can assist us in helping the child through that moment. And she can also offer her perspective from a mental health practitioner when we're giving these talks. So we go into schools and we speak to kids as young as fifth graders and all the way up to, we give presentations through junior high, high school, and at the college level. Marilla, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So one of the things, like Maria said, we'll speak with you know, middle school, high school, college level. And we also go in, especially with schools, if there's an allegation against a teacher or an institution, or if there's, a big crisis at a school district, we actually go and train their teachers, their staff, to be more trauma-informed, to understand the impact of what child abuse can have on a child, how that can affect whether it's the social piece, whether it's grades, the educational aspects. So we'll train all the faculty, the staff, from the support staff to administrators and educators. And we do that often. And we have a really great relationship with the Morris County School District. where they'll bring us in and we can, you know, talk to them about that. We'll even do cyberbullying presentations because we know cyberbullying can be another form of child abuse, especially when our children can be alone and isolated during COVID. We've seen a huge tick of that and a decrease in child abuse reporting. So we go into schools, we talk about child abuse recognition and prevention, and we also do cyberbullying. We've had talks about human trafficking, really anything with childhood abuse and trauma. We'll adapt it to whatever community member or organization needs us to, and we have the specialty to do that.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. It's, you know, I don't like the Zoom thing, okay? I'm not a Zoom person, okay? I enjoy, you know, giving presentations because you feel, I mean, you know, inside, say, like I was using a chapel over at one of the universities I was at. And that way you have a feel for the people, you have a feel for your audience. And I really find it unbelievable how much the professors, okay, didn't know about child abuse, okay? What it does to you, don't forget, those students are sitting there, and a lot of them are going to become social workers, they're going to become, you know, counselors, whatever. And so they need to understand the ramification, what happens to a child, you know, when they do get sexually or physically, mentally, emotionally, or neglected, or all the abuses together, what that child goes through. And I was shocked that several times I also spoke to police officers. They didn't have enough knowledge of it either. Now I'm going to start going to daycare centers again and putting together packages because schools are opening and daycare centers will be busy because parents, I guess, will be out working. And we never know what's going on now because of the COVID. And New Jersey is pretty tough. I don't have to tell you that. You know, it's pretty tough, you know, trying to have the schools open and so forth. But the problem is there. And now, of course, with the mandating reporting, you know, that the school system is supposed to be doing, they can't see the children come in with the bruising or whatever else thing they might suspect because it's a Zoom, okay? You can't tell. So when the schools do open up completely, let me ask you, in Morristown, I used to live in Florham Park, so I wasn't that far away. In Morristown, are the schools opening now?
Yes, they are. But one thing that I can tell you, Morell and I both agree on, that when schools were closed, we were very, very concerned because the phones on the reporting lines stopped ringing.
Right.
And what that means is that child abuse did not stop. It meant that children were suffering in silence. They were isolating with their abusers. And they did not have access to the teachers, school personnel, coaches, family friends, and friends of, you know, their own friends that could tell their own parents. They didn't have access to the people that they would disclose to. So it wasn't that child abuse wasn't happening, but it was happening, and the children were suffering, users, without anyone to tell what was happening to them. So now, as kids are returning to school and playing fields and extracurricular activities and daycare, now we're starting to hear horrific stories of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things
that was very interesting
was there was a hospital study done because there was a decrease in children that were being brought in with injuries. But once children were actually brought in, the injuries were much more serious than they had seen in the past, and a higher percentage of them ended up in the hospital. So parents were hesitating bringing their children in, but the parents that did, the children were much more injured than they had been in the past. And this is due to a lot of factors. When a family is going through stress, and particularly during economically hard times, like a lot of our families did during COVID, it raises the stress level in the houses. Spouses are fighting more. There's issues going on because people have lost their jobs due to you know, the COVID shutdowns, and it raises the level of stress in the household. The other thing that was happening was people were migrating out of the cities and moving in with distant relatives, so that they were having people living with them that were not related to the kids biologically. This caused children to be living with people who were unrelated to them, who did not have the same kind of relation that would cause them not to engage in sexual relations with a child. And because of that, we saw a rise in sexual assaults of children in their own homes. So what we're seeing now, and I have to tell you, just yesterday, we had 6 referrals in one day, 6. And we're going to start seeing that because why? It's September, and the children that have been isolated for the past year and a half are now going back to school, and they're telling their teachers and their peers and their school counselors exactly what happened to them in the past year and a half. They finally had the chance to speak to someone that they trust.
I'm so thankful to hear that. I truly am. I know with the ER rooms, there's a head trauma. Okay, that's what's coming into the ER rooms because I did some study on that. And the brain injuries. So that's why those children are staying. With what you're just saying there, this is a good thing because that means kids are starting to open up. You see, years ago, think about it. Years ago, kids would keep their mouths shut. And if you didn't see those bruises or those broken legs and arms and then the punched-in eyes and everything that happens so often with the physical abuse, sexual, of course, would be more behavioral, how the wording, maybe they're starting to speak like an adult would say things. Or with these younger children, many times they'll act sexual. And you know there's this problem there if they're starting to act in strange ways. It makes you question. That's the red flags. But with the kids back then, they didn't open their mouths. Maybe they were threatened more. I don't know what the heck it was. But today, children are starting to speak up. And we need for them all to speak up, you know. And one thing that I try to do is get across to parents and also to when I do my presentations, one asked at this point, but to let them know, hey, if you're not a parent now, you're going to be a parent someday. And you know what? You better educate your children. And you better get that bond with your child. Because that bonding that you have with your child when you tell them about their body and you tell them what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, it teaches them. And, you know, that makes a child feel much closer to their parent. Because mommy and daddy care enough about me to tell me what to watch out for. You know, it's not just stranger danger. It can happen in the family. It can happen outside of the family. And what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, okay? And so people are starting to talk more because I'll tell you what, Maria, when I wrote my book almost 11 years ago, there was only one other book on Amazon like mine. That was it, okay? So I'm sure she looked every day to see if I got more stars than she did. We were probably going back and forth. You know, I'm telling you, there's only 2 books. So today, if you look on Amazon, books on child abuse are all over the place now. And also, too, what's so good that I'm really happy to see is that people are starting to write books, you know, for children, things that parents can use as a tool, you know, to speak to their children, you know, about what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, in a way that it's not too scary to the child. And, you know, again, so many times I've heard people say to me, and I get so mad, probably because I'm a survivor. And we on NASCA, we're all survivors, 99.9% of us. And let me tell you something, you know, we're told if something happens, you keep it quiet. You don't open your mouth. This is in our family. Or they'll say things to them like, you enjoyed it. I could tell. You know, they say all these things to the children. And children are starting to get a little bit wiser because people now are talking. And your organization, with all the stuff that you do here, right down here at the bottom, with all the places that you go to and speak about child abuse and prevention and reporting. Okay, let's talk about reporting. That's something that people have a little hard time with because many times they're afraid of retaliation. Say they live in an urban area. You mentioned the urbanites before. They said that every fifth to seventh house, something is going on. Reports have shown this. Something is going on every five to seven houses down, okay? And so maybe the guy next door doesn't really want to report their neighbor because they're like handshake houses. You know what I'm saying? You stick your hand out, you can shake hands with your neighbor, you know, and they're going to figure that maybe you're the one that called the police on them. So what do you do? I mean, how do you, with the reporting issue, who do you suggest that people call?
So if anyone suspects a child is being abused and neglected, depending on what mm-hmm. state they live, there should be a hotline for them to call. In New Jersey, it's 1-877-NJ-ABUSE. Again, that's 1-877-NJ-ABUSE. That's the central screening line. Now, what is important to note is that you can make the report anonymously. They may press you for your identity, but you do not have to give it. But what you do have to do is give as much information as you possibly know in order for them to properly respond to your report. They need to know as much detail as you can possibly give them. So you don't need to give them your identification, but you need to give them the identity of the child, if you know it, the child's name, their age, their birthday, the name of their parent, the address where they can be found, the school that they go to, what the abuse is that you suspected, what you have seen. You must give a lot of detail. Find that you're not getting the response that you think you should be getting from your child welfare, whoever you're reporting to, the child welfare, whatever hotline you're reporting to, you can report to local law enforcement or your county prosecutor's office. Because let's face it, child abuse is a crime. A crime has been committed. And just like you would report any other crime, you can call law enforcement and report what you see. And we always tell people, if you see something, say something. Because what you are seeing and what you're reporting, you could save a child's life.
Right.
Many times
exactly.
children don't have a voice, and you need to be their voice. It can be the difference between life and death. How many times do we see on the news or read in the newspaper of a child that dies as a result of the abuse? And then they go back into the neighborhood and they interview neighbors and family friends. And they say, you know, we thought something was happening or we suspected something, but, you know, we didn't want to report it. It's really none of our business. Or we thought that as a family we could handle it. That is the wrong response. That is when children die. So people, I urge people, if you see something, say something. You will not be prosecuted if you're reporting in good faith.
You know what's so important. Go ahead.
It's important for families to understand, especially if you're reporting with a neighbor within your own family, people are trained to help. When we look at the news cases of like the Turpin family where they had 13 kids and things were going wrong and people knew something was happening and no one said anything, like Maria said to her point, that's when kids can pass away. That's when we have child fatalities at young ages. But also one of the things and barriers that we find is children who are experiencing this and families that are undocumented. There's a fear of reporting for fear of law enforcement. And I just want to point out to anyone who may know someone who's undocumented or passing the information that the law enforcement is not going to ask you, and they cannot ask you about your legal status. Regardless if you're documented or undocumented, you cannot be a victim of a crime. So to So be rest assured that if something has happened, regardless of your status, that you can still receive treatment. At Deirdre's house, we do not care if you're documented or undocumented. We'll still provide services. And you're not allowed to be a victim in the state of New Jersey. So that's one thing that we want to break down, that myth and that barrier for families as well.
That's important. That's very, very important. Because, you know, see, we're still, we've come a long ways, all right, in the last, I've been here 11 years with NASCA, and I can see that there's been a difference with people, but still in all, there is that barrier. Yes, they're willing to listen about child abuse, but when it comes to the reporting, then they shy away because they don't want to get involved or they're afraid of retaliation and things like that. But I always stress, too, that you can remain anonymous. You don't have to give your name when you're calling. And that is so important. There's no excuse anymore. There's no excuse. I remember some years ago, and maybe you've heard something about this, either one of you, both of you, whatever. At one time, Florida, now I don't know if they went through with this bill, but in Florida, if a neighbor, say, knew that a child was being beaten up next door, or sexually abused, any of the abuses, and they didn't report it, if all of a sudden something happened to that child and they found out that the person next door knew about it, they too then were going to be in big, bad trouble. And I think that's something that's important because, you see, we have to get people to understand that our children need us. They need a hero. That's what they need. They need a hero. And we can be their hero. And to turn your head and walk the other way, that's not being a hero, okay? That's just saying, I don't give a, you know what. And just, I don't want to be involved, I don't care enough, and all this other stuff. And it's a terrible thing. It truly is a terrible thing. So I think that that should be a law in every state. If you know that a child is being abused and you don't open up your mouth, then you too are going to be held accountable to a certain degree. Maybe it's a big fine, or maybe it's a little bit of imprisonment. Maybe it's a little bit of both. I don't care. Because we have to get through that barrier so that society, in the communities, and in society in general, that they get more proactive, you know, working with child abuse. Like you say, see something, say something. Otherwise, our children, they hardly have a chance. You know what I'm saying?
One of the things that Morel and I continually do is every time that we go into a school, we emphasize to the children that it's not their job to deal with their abuse, that all they need to do is tell a trusted adult, and they should let the adults in their lives handle it. And every single time that we go into a school, we tell kids, we want to help you. We are here to help you. We are here to protect you. But you must tell us. And invariably, in each case, that's why it's so important that Morella comes with me to these speaking engagements. A child will come forward and tell us about abuse that they have suffered or that someone that they know is suffering. So it's important for children to know that the adults in their lives are there for them, that the adults in their lives will not look the other way, that they will take action. And really, we owe that to children because it's not their responsibility to hold adults accountable. It's our responsibility to hold them accountable.
That's right.
And what we tell our children, too, and Maria can testify to this, is we tell the kids, if you don't get a response the first time, keep using your voice. Continue to speak up. Continue to tell the next person and the next person until you get the help. Use your voice, and there is going to be a safe adult who's going to be able to look you in your eyes and tell you, thank you for telling me. It will be okay, and I will help you. And that's what we need. We need those safe adults to be trauma-informed, to be safe for these kids to disclose to, to not have that look of horror or shock when they tell you something and just say and not make false promises. And those are the, you know, that's what we tell our families. How you respond to the abuse for your child is going to be one of the key factors in their healing process.
Right. Absolutely. Oh, there's so much to talk about with this. I'm going to go to the panel in just a second. But I think that, you know, parenting, all right, let's get back to the parents. And hopefully I'm talking about the normal parents, okay, the normal homes. I think that it should be a part of parenting for the adults, you know, for the mommy and daddy to sit down with their children. And, you know, so many times they're embarrassed to talk to them about this. You know this. The experts say, they say, you know, call your body parts what they are. Because in the past, you know, something was called coochie and something else was called something else. You know what I'm saying? No. Look, God gave us a nose. He gave us a head. He gave us breasts. He gave us a vagina. He gave us, you know, whatever, whatever. And, you know, all throughout the body. And if you don't change the tone of your voice, then the children won't think it's funny. It's all inclusive of what you're telling them. And this is something parents have to realize. If they, you know, like a lot of times they'll say the bathing suit area. A lot of people, let me see how you feel about that. They'll, instead of saying, you know, your breast or your vagina or your penis or whatever, they'll say the bathing suit area because they're bashful about actually saying the names of the body parts. How do you feel about that when you're trying to teach your children safety?
So one of the things that our counseling, our clinicians, and when you are in this field and we are working with caregivers and parents, especially on the prevention side, before anything happens, what we tell families is you need to call it for what it is. Like you said, it is not a flower. It is not pumpkin. Whatever name you want to give it, we need to call it for what it is, because if something happens, one, we want to eliminate the shame about our body parts. Two, if
right.
something were to happen and they're using different names and talking about this to some safe person or on the playground or they're mentioning it and no one knows what a flower is, right? You think they're talking about a garden or somebody touched the flower in the house. No. We want to have the language that's appropriate for the kids so that if something were to happen, they're not shy to talk about it. There's no embarrassment. And then law enforcement can also do something and do that. So that's one of the primary things. Another tip that I give families and parents is to have a conversation about body safety, boundaries, and also that the people that can only touch your body part when it goes at developmental ages, but a doctor can only do this in the eye shot of mom and dad when we're in the bathroom and when we're at the doctor's office. I'm going to clean you up to a certain age, right? Like those are the things that parents have to keep in mind when they're giving a shower to the kid. That's one of the tips that I give to families all the time is have these conversations during bath time. It's some of the easiest way to, you know, alleviate some of the bashfulness from parents. Is when you're taking your kid a bath, start talking about, you know, what private parts are, what no one can touch, right? It's part of the bathing suit, but also we don't want to forget the mouth. The mouth is a part parts where a lot of alleged offenders, they use the mouth in different ways. So that's also a private part, right? And also,
absolutely.
We talk to families about discussing what's the difference between a secret and a surprise, right? That a surprise is something that eventually somebody's going to know, a birthday party, something good, but secrets are not to be held in our household. Secrets are not okay. If any adult tells you to keep it a secret or that they're going to do something, know that they're lying, and you can come and talk to me at any point, right away.
I think that was very important. Actually, where you're saying secrets and surprises, that is huge. I think there's a lot of children who need to hear that again and again and again.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And there is a huge difference between that. And we want to make sure, you know, before we used to think about stranger danger, but what we know about child abuse, what we know about sexual abuse is that 90% is somebody that the child knows, whether it's a caregiver, whether it's somebody in their life, a friend, a parent, 90% is somebody we know. So it's not very kind of that Hollywood. Yes, that happens, right? It's a stranger on the street. It's a kidnapping or something. But 90% of the time, it's someone that's close to the family. It's somebody in the family. It's somebody who's close to the child. So we want to give all of that information about secrets versus surprises, about body parts, also including the mouth. That is so critical. Giving the right names to the body parts and eliminating that. Talking about who can touch you, boundaries, talking about safety with doctors, and also for parents to understand that kids naturally are going to want to explore their bodies, right? What they should be concerned about versus if it's aggressive, if it's not, you know, if it's not aggressive, that's typical body exploration, and they can be redirected to, you know, this is only done in private or in the bathroom. And then if the kids can respond to that, that's appropriate. But if there's aggression behind or anything, we want you to talk to, seek professional help for your child or your family and so on.
And what's important to know also,
that also includes, you know, like older siblings too, you know, they're finding out a lot. You know, that like older siblings, if they tend to be that way, okay, like say like a pedophile, all right, they say by the time you're 15 years old, you know that you're different. Actually, some say 13. I've heard both. I'm not sure which is right. But the point is, they know they're different. And they may go after their own siblings or some, you know, child down the street. And I did call, Maria, I did call. Yes, I did. A place down in Avalon that housed teenage pedophiles because they had committed a crime and they got caught. And I thought maybe I'd have them on the show. Ha ha. Well, anyway. All right. So I called and I was speaking to the director and having a nice conversation with her. Then I started asking her, you know, about success rate, okay? Like, is this a successful type of treatment program? What do you have to offer? Things like that. The typical things you ask. And she hung up on me. So she didn't want to make any commitments or say anything. But you see, when kids are in the house, okay, during the COVID, this awful thing that we went through, and I pray to God we don't go through that again, okay, there's so much violation that happens, so many perpetrators right within their own family, and that makes it double trouble, okay? I know this for a fact. It makes it double trouble to go out and tell someone because it's family. And so it really takes a very astute person, a very good therapist or a good clinician, whomever, you know, who can even spot some things. So you were speaking about that during the Zoom time, you couldn't see, and I was speaking about it also. You couldn't see the bruising, and then when they came back to school, they started talking, opening up, and mentioning all the things that happened at home. And this is a very unfortunate thing, because so much does happen at home, okay? And that also even adds to the humiliation. Go ahead.
One of the things that we had to do during COVID, because everybody was operating through Zoom, is we actually had to educate teachers and give teachers the right tools to be able to notice when things were going wrong in a household. If you had a child in a room and you heard shouting in the background, or there was a lot of disruption in the household, or, which happened a lot, children were completely disengaged from learning and were not even logging on. It was the highest rate of school truancy in the history of the U.S. school system, where their kids were just not even logging on. And so teachers had to understand that when children were not logging on, they needed to report that. And someone needed to go investigate when children were completely disappearing from classrooms and not engaging in learning at all. So, you know, during the whole pandemic, we had up on our website, we still have that, we had tips for teachers to understand the signs that they should be looking at when they're engaging with kids remotely. The other thing that we did, and this was through the National Children's Alliance, was there was a huge national campaign
that reached out to people that did see children in person during the pandemic, like delivery drivers, Uber drivers, people that would were bringing food to people's houses, because they were seeing the kids where other people were not. And we were saying, you may be this child's only chance. So if you, Mr. UPS driver, Miss UPS driver, are delivering something to a home, and a child, and you see a child in distress, you have to say something, because you may be the only chance that child has to get help.
Right. I think we should all be mandated reporters. I don't think it should be just in the school system or in some churches or organization, other organizations. We have so many problems with the churches and, of course, the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, too. They don't talk about that as much. But I think that everyone, every person, every regular person, Joe Blow down the street, everybody, everyone, they should all be mandated reporters, because I think that's the only way, you know, one of the only ways, okay, that children have a better chance, you know, to get these monsters, to get these monsters off the street. I call them monsters, sorry. I went through too much. They're monsters to me, you know. And so I think that if everyone was made a mandated reporter and they knew they had that power, you know, to be a mandated reporter, and they made those phone calls, your line would be ringing off the wall, okay? Let's not just wait for the people in charge, like in schools, in the school system, or youth groups of other kinds, other organizations. And so often, too, don't forget, look at Penn State. Look what happened over there. They were like, they weren't going to tell anyone, were they? And then Sandusky got caught, and we know the whole story on that. So a lot of times, if we wait just for the school system or other organizations that you would supposedly trust, we need everyone to be a mandated reporter. That's my take on it. Absolutely. I want to bring Bill back in here. He's probably wondering what the heck I'm doing. He's the boss. Bill, you have something to say? You have something to say to this?
Of course I do. But I don't wonder when you're doing. I just try to I pray that the audience that's listening can make sense of it most of the time. No, I'm kidding. I have a note for you, Carol. We are mandated reporters in most places, but the punishment is so small, and the consciousness, both in law enforcement cases and the community's cases, is too small. We're not well aware of it. But there are some small penalties for withholding that kind of information, and in essence. We are mandated reporters. We're not named in the community itself is not named in the law that says teachers
right.
and healthcare workers and doctors and so forth. But we are, and we can be held accountable. That saying we can become accountable is not the same as holding someone accountable. And there are very,
right.
very, very, very few cases that someone will be taken, you know, to have their hands slapped in a courtroom. Just because they knew something was going on with a family and they didn't report it, but that it can happen. It's very, very rare, and I think that's one thing we could definitely improve on. I mean, just remembering the phrase that was used earlier in the show: "If you see something, say something." You know, that's pretty much succinctly put. We also used that for the terrorist threat after 9/11, but it's a good one. You know, it's something law enforcement understands. It's something the community understands. And it's something mandated reporters understand. But I want there to be simply more belief. Okay, I think that we have all encountered times when children, perhaps they're not being abused right then, they try to tell somebody and it's misunderstood or it's taken wrongly. This can also happen. You know, say in through your 20s, you can have people not believe you, and you can have a difficult time actually finding someone who will take you seriously. We're trying to do two things here, ladies. We're trying to do to educate the public, especially as concerned to getting it over the taboo of child sexual abuse, and, you know, about all the aspects of prevention, intervention, and recovery, but at least get them to be willing to have the discussion. And then secondly, to offer hope and healing and different programs and tools to the survivor. But, you know, if you don't have the community, somebody used this phrase before, and I use it all the time, if you don't have a trauma-informed community, then you don't have, you have ears that this information will not fall on. This information will fall by the wayside instead. And I'm one of those people who tried to tell and tried to get help, and, you know, over and over, nothing no help came to me. I wasn't believed and so forth. So it is daunting when you're a child and you're not believed, because you may tell several people, which I did, and I wasn't believed at any of them. And I had to wait, you know, another, I don't know, till I was 30 to be believed. And that was in an adult group where I was kind of claiming my chair, you know. But I just want us to know that the most important ingredient here when we're talking about, you know, children at home is the parents. They're the ones that see the children all the time. Now, I know that the parents are also, by and large, the biggest set of abusers, but it's usually not, sometimes it is, it's not everybody in the family who abuses the children. It's usually one person in the family. And, you know, if the mother sees something wrong with the child and suspects the father, I think she has an obligation to the child instead of an obligation to try and hold the family together. It's the same dynamic as domestic violence.
That's right.
You know, so anyway, that's just a few thoughts there, Carol, I'll give to you. Thank you very much. You're doing a great job.
Yeah, they're wonderful. That's why I love them so. You know, he makes a point. Look, kids have to come first. And so many people have said to me, oh, I don't want, in fact, it happened over in Sears once. I've mentioned this a few times on air when Sears was still around. I showed you how long ago it was. But anyway, the point is this. I was over at the jewelry section. Anyway, I was over at the jewelry section, and this lady and I started to talk. She said to me, you know, she asked me what type of thing I did, and I told her I've worked with all the different places I've worked, and then finally, of course, with NASCA. And this, of course, is volunteer. We do this from our heart, okay? We don't get paid for what we do here. But the point is this, we are a 501c3, and if anyone wants to donate, it would be nice, okay? I have a lot of stuff that I have coming out, but it comes out of my pocket. That's all right. This is my mission. But the point is this, she said, oh, I didn't want to tell when I was growing up because, quite frankly, I didn't want to ruin the family. I didn't want the family's name to go down the gutter. And I said to her, but what about you? What about you and your feelings? What have you gone through? And it turns out she had panic attacks like I did. So we had a lot to talk about. So you see, you know, people have to understand that it's not the family. You're not going to worry about the family. It's the individual, all right? The individual has rights, too. In fact, we who have more rights than the family that you're so worried about, you know, protecting. You don't protect. What you do is you open your mouth, you say something. And I wanted to ask you something I see here because we're coming pretty close to the end of the show. We're getting close anyway. You also speak at, maybe both of you do this, at corporations. What do you do at corporations? What type of material do you give them?
Well, when we go speak to a corporation, it's the same as you would speak to any other community organization. We're trying to promote awareness. We want to give people information on how to report, how to spot the signs of child abuse, because, again, the community, they're our first line of defense. We can't be everywhere. So we need as many eyes and ears as we possibly can get, so that when a child is reaching out for help, there's somebody there that can see it and act on it. So when we go speak to corporations, we're talking to them again. How do you report? What are the signs of child abuse? And, you know, especially in a large corporation, there are families that are affected by abuse.
and we have to give them the tools to get the help that they need. So corporations, we treat them like any other community organization when we're going out and we're educating them as if we're educating any other community organization.
Okay, good, good. And then with the school system, I have a little bit of a peeve with this, you can tell. I did fine in the universities because they're all adults, right? But with the younger children, did the schools that you approached, did they send notes home to the parents and say, well, so-and-so is going to be here and so-and-so, someone else is going to be here also speaking, you know, about what to look out for, maybe date rape, whatever. If the kids are older, that would be more high school. But I take that back. They start as early as seventh grade now, whatever, going out. But did you have a problem with that? Was that a roadblock in your way? Because the parents then would say, oh, no, we want to tell our own children, you know, about the facts of life and what can happen, what can't happen, the good, the bad, and the ugly, as I put it. Did you ever run into that?
Well, you know, I've been doing this since 2003. And at that time, mm-hmm. there was a little bit of that. But now I mm-hmm. think that they are more aware that their children have to be educated, and they have to be educated, unfortunately, at a much earlier age, and they're much more receptive. But we do let parents know that we're coming into the school because we want to make sure that we're not triggering any children that may be listening to our presentation. Because we talk to children the way they process abuse, and the fact that if you don't process it in a healthy way, some children engage in self-harm. So we want to make sure that there are no children that we're going to be speaking to that are going to be triggered in any way. So before we go speak in a school, we actually give the school a copy of our presentation so they can tell us how they needed to be tweaked in any way. And many times we tweak it because a school is having a particular issue, especially when we're talking about cyberbullying, which we consider another form of child abuse. So we talk to a school and say, what kinds of things are you seeing in your community that you need us to talk about or you need us to focus on a little bit more than other points? So we work with the schools in order to tailor the presentations. But what we don't do is we don't pull any punches. We let the kids know, you know, if they're hurting, this is who they need to speak to, that they're not alone. And, you know, parents have not objected to that. And we have developed very, very good partnerships with schools.
Well, that's a good way. That's a good way to do it. I remember this is some years ago. I walked into a grade school, and with appropriate, you know, age-appropriate type of material. And at that time, now mind you, a lot has happened since. I think since Hollywood came out and they were starting to talk about, you know, abuse, and if they were going to get a better part for, you know, for a movie that they were going to be in, they had to lie on the couch. I'm not going to get graphic here, but you know what I'm saying. And they came out. And then the guy who ran Friends, he actually opened up a clinic, but it was only for Hollywood. Okay, that wasn't so good. I mean, it should have been for everyone, but it was just for the Hollywood brats, as he put it, the Hollywood brats. But the point is that by sending information first, you know, to the school system, I think that's a good idea, because that way they can have their meetings, they can sit and talk about it, and which, of course, is what they do, and then decide whether they're going to, you know, let the parents or, you know, have the kids take it home to the parents, so forth and so on. Because, quite frankly, I went into this school one day, and the secretary was there. I put down NASCA material and so forth. This is just about when I first started NASCA, so maybe a year, 2 years, whatever. And she stood up, looked at me like I was from Mars, and turned and walked straight into the principal's office, and he looked out the door like I was definitely a Martian, whatever. And they didn't want my presence or anybody else's presence, you know, in their school, because for what you just said, because of triggering problems and things like that, because there are, of course, so many children are sexually abused, the one in the four and the one in the six, okay, as we know, one in four girls and one in six approximately boys. They're kind of moving those numbers around a little bit, saying one in three and one in five. So, but it's pretty close. So that can, I think, present a problem. But I like the idea of instead of going in, giving them a whole spiel, which is what I did over at the colleges that I worked in, you know, worked at, it's a good idea to send a letter, like you said, and what you're going to present. I like that idea. I like that. Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
We actually give them a copy of the PowerPoint that we're going to present so they can see exactly the materials that we're going to present. And also mm-hmm. what we do, we're very careful in tailoring the material for the age group and the developmental level of the children that we're going to be presenting to. If we're presenting to teachers and staff, it's a completely different presentation than if you're dealing with fifth graders or high school students
right.
or junior high.
So exactly.
We have, you know, various different presentations that we do, and we're very, very good at tailoring to the audience that we're going to be presented to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like that idea. I might try that again because I think I took them off guard. Many times I'm starting this up again, I go into daycare centers. Since people are going back to work, they need their daycare centers. And I do present them. They are supposed to have approximately 18 hours of information, professors coming in, maybe clinical, the psychiatrist, whomever, to speak about child abuse so that the daycare center staff especially, and it's up to the director too, to educate the staff, to look for bruising, different type of behavior patterns and the things that kids display who are, being abused. And so I give them a lot of NASCA information because our website is quite good. And so there's a lot, I make a lot of copies, I hand it to them. And one was very, quite dirty. I had to report them because it was very, very dirty, not well cared for at all. But the point is, I think that, the younger you start, age appropriately, I mean, you can tell, when your child is ready to start hearing about their bodies and also, too, giving them boundaries and what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. And another thing, too, I think over at the schools, when they have the volunteers come in, like during baseball time and soccer and football, I think it's a good idea to take a good look at them as well. I did write an article for the Pittsburgh newspaper about that because we were covering things at that time right here on the show, and that the volunteers should even be looked at because just because they're a volunteer doesn't mean they're a good person. They could be a pedophile. That they can have problems of their own. So they thanked me for my letter and said they were going to look into it. I don't know if they did or not, but I figured let me drop the seed, okay, because I know that pedophiles do hang where children go, let's face it. They go over to schoolyards. That's where one of my perpetrators, I became his prey, okay, and, because they do go where children go. So you have to educate people in all areas of concern. And so the school did thank me for that letter, and they thought that it was a good idea, and I don't know what they did with it. But anyway, so what I do usually, what we do here on the show, I know my clock is about maybe 2 minutes fast. But first of all, I want to thank you both for coming on. You're so, so very good at what you do. And I always tell people about you. I'm one of your fans. Yes, I am. And I put
Thank
it on
you.
Our own. I put you on our own Facebook, and so forth, so that people could understand to listen to this show later on. If you're busy tonight's Friday, now you're busy. Whatever, listen to it because I knew that they'd get. It would be a wonderful show, and this certainly has been. So, what we do at the end of the show is we allow for you and maybe Marilla also too to just give some words of advice and hope to people out there. You know, all right, your child has been abused. This is a terrible thing, but there is healing after abuse as long as they get the proper attention that they need, things like that. But why don't you go first, Maria? Go ahead.
I think what we always try to remind people is that a child's life may be changed by the abuse that they've suffered, but it doesn't have to be defined by it. It's what we do in the aftermath of that abuse that dictates whether that child's life is going to be full of healthy, happy, making they can continue on, or whether or not they're going to have permanent scars. So again, mm-hmm. a child's life does not have to be defined by the abuse as long as they get the help that they need at the, as close to the time as the abuse occurring as they possibly can. They rely on the adults to do the right thing, and we have to do the right thing. And so I would just remind people, again, if you see something, say something. Do not hesitate. A child's life may depend on it.
That's right. That's exactly right. Absolutely. And what about you, Marilla? Would you like to have something to say, too?
Sure. If you have a child who has been abused, or if you are a survivor of abuse, have experienced trauma in any way, that you will still have a beautiful life, despite how long it's taken, despite how much you have endured, that you can still have a beautiful life. And this does not have to define you. That healing is a journey. It's not a location. It's not a goal. It's a journey. And when you start to take that journey, there might be ebbs and flows, but that beautiful life, I assure you, is at the end of the tunnel. And every day there is a chance for hope, healing, and whatever justice means to you, that's also possible. So thank you for having us. It was a great talking to you.
Well, we had a wonderful show. Oh, listen here. Again, I told you, I'm one of your biggest fans. and I learned something, too. I didn't realize that there's so many organizations that are popping up here and there. And that, again, gives me hope. You know, I'm a survivor. And what kids go through, you know, who don't have organizations like your organization, it's horrific. It doesn't help the child any. It just makes things worse. It absolutely does. And that doesn't mean that the police are being, you know, nasty or anything like that. Not at all. But it just adds more confusion to the child and more things that they have to face. Oh, tomorrow I have to go and I have to have the exam at the hospital. Oh, my God, you know, and oh, now I have to go to court and I have to see that monster. These are things that go through a kid's heads. All right, I know. And so to have an organization that has so many people involved, like you had mentioned, you know, working under one roof and talking to the children and being trained how to do that, you know, certainly would take a lot of the stress level off of the child. And so I thank you from the bottom of my heart, you and the other organizations that do the same thing, because I know all too well, you know, being one of 14, that particular day, what that felt like. So, okay, our show is over, and I want to thank you so much. And we're not going to wait another 4 or 5 years, whatever the heck it's been. I don't remember what it was.
Well,
thank you so much. I think you're both great. I love you to death. Okay, so good night, and God bless you, and we'll talk soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
God bless. Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You often got it after all that you've done.
Blog Talk Radio.